Welcome again to the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. In today's episode, I talked with Ryan O'Connor from Crossroads Capital. We discussed a wide variety of topics like big tech, index concentration, and the investment thesis behind Vistry and Nintendo. Before jumping right into the episode, let's hear about today's sponsor, Public.com. Are you paying too much to trade options? If you're not trading on Public.com, the answer is yes. Public is the only platform where you can earn a rebate on every option contract traded. And that's in addition to no commissions or per contract fees. There's no one else out there paying trading rebates, so you won't find a better deal. Bottom line, if you're paying more than $0 to place an options trade, then you're paying too much. Switch to Public and start getting rebates on every single contract traded, only at public.com. Full disclosure, paid for by Public Investing, options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description. Come once again to the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. Today I have the pleasure of having here a great guest and one that my subscribers probably know because I'm also invested in Nintendo. And if you're talking about Nintendo, then Ryan's name probably comes up. So thank you very much, Ryan, for coming to the podcast.
My pleasure, Leandro. I've been a big fan of your podcast. It's an honor to be here.
Okay, so we've got a lot of things to go through. So I think it's best if we start with you, Ryan, maybe with a description of yourself, like an introduction of yourself, your background as an investor, and maybe how you started in Crossroads Capital. I mean, I think a lot of people will know you, but maybe others don't.
Sure. So I guess a bit about my background personally. So I spent a few years locally as an analyst for a few firms, worked at a local family office. Prior to that, I traded options at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which is a unique point of differentiation. We have employed options or layered them into our value-centric approach pretty successfully over time, but nothing out of the ordinary there, somewhat a non-traditional background. As far as what made me fall in love with investing, that's, I'd say, deeply implanted from the time I was a kid. My grandparents were very lucky. My grandfather was the particularly large influence. He was one of the original investors in the Buffett partnerships way back in the early 60s. And so he very much embraced concepts like a margin of safety, the miracle of compound interest, the power of contrarian thinking, things along those lines. I was a kid that got a copy of The Richest Man in Babylon for my 10th birthday and had heard more acorns grow into trees metaphors than you can imagine. But he taught me a lot, outside of just instilling in me the heart of a value investor, taught me a million things that are all directly related to my vocational pursuits here. One of the things that reminds me most is just the way his example taught me what real earned conviction looks like, and by extension, how hard it is to find investment. So people we're sticking with for the long haul. And even if you find them, I think you find that most people would either sell too early or move. Their PM had done quite well and maybe too well, and it's wise to diversify. He deeply leaned against the grain and in all those ways. Taught me that very simplistically that I wanted to be the guy that found Walmart in the 70s or Microsoft in the mid 80s or Amazon in the 90s. Or Netflix in the mid 2000s. I think as an investor, the hardest thing of all is to develop the conviction that allows you to hold. That's self-evidently how the real money is made. And just the importance of developing primary insights, original insights, connecting dots, seeing the runway, doing all that without giving in to self-doubt, boredom, the ever-present temptation to simply do something in this business as if discipline. This was a discipline where results were determined by activity or effort rather than just being right. But in the end, just witnessing through my life what the power of intelligent investing can do for a family, the way it changed the arc of my own family over time is semi-mind-blowing and big part of my inspiration of what we do here. My favorite piece of family memorabilia is Buffett writing my grandparents in, I think, the early 2000s and talking about kind of the joy of serving the same people that backed him before he was Warren Buffett and kind of the joy that brings. And we very much attempted to replicate that at Crossroads. So as far as Crossroads Capital and kind of the firm specifically, we manage a longshore investment partnership kind of aspires to be the single best fund in the U.S. at identifying and owning high quality businesses undergoing value unlocking change. In terms of strategy and process, our fund is very much modeled after the original Buffett LP. The main way to think about that is we not only manage risk from the bottom up, but from the top down. And I don't mean that in necessarily a macro sense, but in terms of portfolio construction and ensuring that each of our investments works in conjunction towards the whole. And the relation to the Buffett partnership is our kind of bread and butter is focused on two key cohorts. I call them underfollowed small and microcap growth businesses that are, we call them high quality compounders for the crowd has caught on, and then special situations. And these are just investments where the near to medium term performance is tied to an upcoming event or a significant corporate change. So situations where the unlocking of value isn't correlated to the stock market, but to company level actions and outcomes. And you know, this has worked well for us because they tend to have countercyclical behavioral characteristics. And in down markets, the special situations tend to do better. And in bull market, the compounders do better. That's it in a nutshell. So far, so.
No, that's great. And you mentioned that you invest in high quality companies that are like have a significant event coming that probably is going to unlock value. What do you refer to as a high quality company? So what characteristic would you look for in a company to claim that it's high quality?
That's a great question. I think about, I guess, when you think about business value, the equation is pretty simple. It's return on capital minus cost of capital times the reinvestment times the length of the competitive advantage period. So that probably sounds jargony, but you know.
Well, this is the first time I actually hear it as a formula, and I think it's a formula worth printing out. Because it's exactly that.
I would very much agree. So simplistically, we want a moat in place, preferably an expanding moat and a long investment runway. That means high barriers to entry, high ROIC, and obviously a long runway to profitably reinvest capital at high return. Just thinking about what we look for, an ideal long, pretty simple. We want a highly asymmetric risk reward equation. You could think of that as a 2-year return expectation of 100% with your downside reasonably capped at say 15 to 20% or less, looking out 24 to 36 months. So we want to buy at a big discount to medium-term earnings power. Obviously, a big part of that equation and the most important of them all is a margin of safety. So we want a massive downside protection provided by a large discount to our estimate of conservative growing the intrinsic value. So limited downside, we get that in a number of ways. Preferably, it's supported by the entry price, a strong balance sheet, and cash flow fundamentals. So ideally, all three. You could break that into various buckets. So the cash or securities on the balance sheet. This is relevant to Nintendo in particular. Hidden intangible assets. So that could be stakes in other businesses, own real estate, or a platform, pedigree-edge platform. We want platform optionality. So levers to pull that can't be seen historically through the rear view. And then typically we want a high free cash flow yield and a cheap multiple on very predictable medium-term earnings power. So I would add to this couple other points from an ideal standpoint. We like defensive operating models. So call it anti-fragile businesses with staying power. We put a very high premium on predictability. So high visibility is important. And typically we like to find businesses that are approaching a cash flow inflection point. So you can think about that as underappreciated operating momentum. So that's a key part of what we look for. Another is not economic selling pressure. The first part of our process is we fire up the spreadsheets pretty much last. The most important thing is knowing why we're so lucky, why the person on the other side of the trade is dumb enough to sell us their equity at a price that we think makes no sense. And for selling is probably the two sexiest words in this business, where a large amount of sellers are selling for reasons that have very little to do with the fundamentals of the business or its quality. Outsider management, I think of this as an exceptional owner operator, strategic thinker that has skin in the game and in a long history of value creation. I kind of side point alongside this culture. I think culture is incredibly important, especially maybe one of the most important drivers of our investment returns over time. The fact is the future is uncertain and you never know what type of kind of left-tailed kick to the balls, for lack of a better term, can challenge a company. They can come out of nowhere. And so having a really good feel for the company's culture gives us insight into whether the company can be relied on to make the right value maximizing decisions, whatever the future holds. If I were to define culture, typically that's a founder or founding team that can inspire and do so with real moral authority. I think generally the fact pattern is the company has a simple mission and is pursued with kind of a missionary zeal, a relentless focus on customers. And I think 4 and 5 are also equally important, which is an entrepreneurial willingness to experiment. And then, of course, an exceptionally long-term time horizon. They don't necessarily need to think of a 50-year business plan in Nintendo style. But, you know, I want to be sure that you have a good culture and they're always looking at the right North Star, which is returns on that invested capital and what's best for the company looking out over a very long time horizon. So,
And you talked there about several topics that I consider to be, let's say, better analyzed by looking at the past, right? You talk about anti-fragility. You also talked about culture. And I know you opened your annual letter with a quote from Charlie Munger that talked about how important the past is to learn about the future. So how do you apply this to your investment process? Do you focus a lot on the past? And if you do, what do you look at?
So I think you're trying to get to the heart of what we do. It's about both the past and the future, both and rather than either or. So when it comes to history, we've always been kind of case study nuts and very focused on learning the lessons of the past and applying them in smart and creative ways that will ultimately result in outsized risk-adjusted return. The way we apply those learnings, practically speaking, will vary quite a bit. But I think it's fair to say that it's not an exaggeration to say that kind of everything we do process-wise takes history into account. And I think in a very real sense, it's one of the things that we're best at. So I mentioned how my grandfather kind of instilled in me the kind of inarguably unhealthy amount of wanting to find the great wealth creators of the future I think part of doing that is by studying the common fact patterns that define history's greatest wealth creator. So to do that's been exceptionally helpful for how we've invested our capital over time. I mean, we talked about Walmart, I mentioned Microsoft, NVIDIA, Netflix, well before the crowd had caught on, but another one that if we have time to, maybe we'll get to later on, but NBR in the mid-90s and how that relates to Vistream, which we look at as NBR 2.0, but better to keep it pithy. But by understanding the past, I think you guys talked on your recent pod with the guys from Speedwell, which I thought was just excellent all around. But at the end of the day, it's by reverse engineering the qualitative attributes that made these kind of right-tailed, extremely skewed positive outcomes possible, that helps us identify and uncover, at least as we hope, businesses of a similar magnitude early in the S-curve, well before the magnitude of the moat is broadly appreciated and the long-term opportunity that we've identified that's readily apparent. So at the same time, when I talk about the future, different way to talk about how I think about using history with respect to our investment process. Really just striving to marry the best lessons of the past with kind of novel insight about the present. Pretty much by definition, our focus is, as I mentioned earlier, on uncovering extraordinary value unlocking change. And basically by definition, that means the future and the past are going to look very different. So if I were trying to be as linguistically precise as possible, I'd say it's not so much that we spend a lot of time trying to predict the future. We don't forecast the future at all. Rather, I think we recognize change that's already underway that the markets don't understand or properly appreciate. And this is a critical distinction. So what we're trying to do, like Nintendo, say in late 2018, when we first got involved, is recognizing reality today, not as we wish it would be, but as it is, cause and effect, et cetera, and not at all about reading some crystal ball. I think Howard Marks speaks pretty brilliantly on this topic, far better than I ever could. So it's a long-winded, rantish way, very much about both, it marrying the best of each approach.
Okay, I think a good example to talk about this probably is big tech, right? I know that you wrote something related to the topic in your latest annual letter, which I'll leave in the description, by the way. You mentioned in your letter that you thought that big tech was going to start to face competition from China, and maybe a lot of people were not appreciating this risk. Can you talk a bit about this and maybe what big techs do you think are most exposed to this risk?
Sure. So yeah, in the letter, we try to draw upon the lessons of the past to inform our kind of position with respect to the indices in general. And we go through a variety of different elements that, I don't know, give us the pretty strong conviction, at least looking out over the long term, that at least for the Mag 7, the last 10 years are probabilistically speaking not going to look like the next 10 years. And there's a variety of reasons for that, China being a very large part. But it's like, first, you're dealing with companies that information technology, the tech industry is by definition rapidly changing. Today's disruptors are tomorrow's disrupted. And I actually think the pace of disruption and the speed at which moats, or at least historical moats, can be competed away is rapidly accelerating. So that's one risk to the future in the past, at least with respect to the Mag 7, being very different. Another is that a lot of the companies that are at the vanguard of a new pet wave, the flavor of the month, often end up dead in the water, and predicting how the competitive balance will shake out is a incredibly difficult thing to do, arguably impossible. So I think we mentioned the latter hat shakeouts in the computer industry. We talked about how many people remember Compaq or Commodore, Sun Microsystems, the early .com. Every Ask Jeeves isn't going to become Google. So while we don't doubt that generative AI will be a revolutionary technology in many respects, I think picking winners early on is very difficult. And that's another big reason why, you know, expecting the Mag 7 to deliver a repeat performance is fraught with error. A third point I'd make is, as we let in, is with China. I think if you look at each of the Mag 7, they all have very sizable weak points when it comes to their Chinese tech counterpart, especially given that in almost every case, they're backed by the Chinese government, who could exert significant pressure on their profitability and growth prospect if so inclined in a couple of key ways. Then also you have the issues with Taiwan. Should China limit or cut off access to Taiwanese semis, obviously that would be a disaster for not just their earnings, but their multiple. Is it going to happen tomorrow? No. But looking out over the next several years, I think it's much more likely, if not, you know, highly probable. And so high level, if you look at aggregate the Mag 7, I heard someone refer to it as the Mag 6 now, with Tesla kind of pulling off. And really, as far as the first two quarters of this year, more like the Mag 1, or maybe the Mag 2 with NVIDIA in China, or NVIDIA and Apple, excuse me, which I believe single-handedly, those two stocks are responsible for over 2/3 of returns in the first two quarters of the year, which is crazy. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that the fortunes of the Mag 7 in the decade ahead are inextricably linked to China. And if you study history, been, I think, beyond appropriately demonstrated the industries that China wants to dominate don't make money. You could look at textiles, you could look at cell phones, chemicals, solar panels, you name it. The end game pretty much remains the same, which is that the industry is quickly commoditized. as the Chinese, not just competence, but their willingness to compete fiercely. And when I say fiercely, I'm basically another way of saying a willingness to be satisfied with profitability and margins that are a tiny fraction of what a firm like NVIDIA or Apple would require. So if you look at history, when you have the CCP back the strategic industries, they have basically every instance crushed the rest of the industry's ability to compete and really to survive. And so I think when you have this particular combination kind of gunning for our biggest and best, ignoring that, I think it is, you know, you're doing it at your own peril, for lack of a better term. So, and then finally, last point is just the difficulty of company grows larger, and dominates its industry, the amount of needle moving investment, reinvestment opportunities dwindles, also brings in legal complications. When your market cap is measured in trillions of dollars, avoiding antitrust lawsuit and the rest, as basically Apple, Microsoft, and Google can all confirm, get progressively harder. So I think that for indexing, or at least market cap weighted indexers, hoping for a repeat of the past performance in the decade ahead is, at least based on history and statistically speaking, anything but a high probability bet, for lack of a better term. So as far
as one question here, you talked there about, let's say, that the disruption in a world of intangibles, right? Because I mean, common knowledge, or let's say the consensus, is that intangible businesses maybe can get, their moats can get competed away, right? Because there are not significant barriers to entry to writing code, for example. But yeah, if we look at the big tech, a lot of these companies have been dominant already for quite a while, right? I mean, since their histories are not super large, but obviously the history of technology being like super penetrated across the consumer is also not so large. Do you think that there's something more besides the code per se? I mean, right now we're seeing generative AI start to become viral, and a lot of these companies have, let's say, reacted maybe late, but at the same time with enough time to be able to deploy that generative AI using their distribution. So what I'm going with this is that I think that distribution is also a very important advantage, right? If another one innovates, another company, but you are able to innovate until before they gain significant distribution, then you basically kill their business model, right? Because you can distribute it to a lot of companies, a lot of customers.
Yes. So there's no doubt. I mean, to be clear, I think all of the Mag 7 are wonderful businesses. And without getting into all the things that, where it really is different this time, with whether it's power laws and all the things that we kind of detail in our letter, there's no doubt that tougher to catch up to leading companies today than it has been in the past. And conversely, the downside for firms that can't keep up is, I think, far larger. But as you point out, the inverse is also true. So I would put it this way, the impact of disruption today is certainly more skewed relative to history, and not just to the downside, but to the upside as well. It happens faster than ever too.
It's more like a winner take all, right? So the big companies become like super huge, but obviously there's a long tail of failures.
Yes, indeed. And I also think when you think about business disruption in a world of intangibles, not only is it happening faster, but I think ironically, I think a lot of at least US companies very much strive for kind of the platonic ideal of capital light businesses. And I think you hit on a very important point with respect to software, which I don't really think software is going to give you a durable moat these days. I mean, potentially scale, network effects, the things that once the platforms reach exit velocity are very hard to dislodge, but there are countless examples of exactly that happening. So, but I think if you look at for example, the Chinese internet companies and that ecosystem, they have a very different approach. And what I mean by that is they'll get their hands dirty and actually invest significant sums of capital. Like, for example, if they want to get distribution advantage and they're selling into, I don't know, convenience stores, they'll literally go out and buy convenience stores. That's not something that you typically see in US firms. So I think the willingness to, as far as creating a truly enduring moat, long-tail, durable earnings growth, has a lot to do with taking the opposite approach today and building out, making the investment that will protect against the risks, or I'd say the increasing risks that come from disruption, you know, in a world built off increasingly intangible, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, do you think that the fact that these companies are winner take all and the indices are getting increasingly concentrated around these companies, what do you think that will eventually lead to? I mean, you briefly touched on it, saying that maybe an equal weight is better than a market cap weight going forward. But the thing, why I ask this is because you see a lot of people saying that NVIDIA has made up a lot of this year's gains, which is actually obviously true. That's a fact. But at the same time, if you are sure that's not going to be the case going forward, then if you just wait, then the indices are going to start like going down quite a bit, right? If NVIDIA and Apple start to fall, which everyone thinks they will eventually.
Right, right. Trees don't grow to the skies, simplistically. So that's a great question. And I think I could address it in a variety of ways. But I would say that we're getting at a point in terms of adoption of passive forms of investing in their kind of overall market share that are, I think, basically, for various reasons, strike at the heart of not only the efficient market theory, which passive investing is based on, but because of structural differences today relative to the past, may go, right? I'm not exactly sure how the future will unfold on this way or unfold, but I will say where I think the odd of kind of where the odds lie. And so I guess one way to think about the differences that I'm getting at right now is, so in the past, one could reliably, I think, even till I'd say, I don't know, within the last 5 years, depend on the fact that kind of rotation within the index would save them, as it has in the past. I think that's demonstrably not true. And I say that because the working assumption underpinning basically all forms of holistic market cap weighted indexation, depend on various premises. But one is that the S&P is a reasonable mirror of the breadth of the U.S. economy. So you could think about it in a different way. In principle, index funds and call it sector theme-based ETFs were originally designed for quick and easy portfolio diversification. And again, to go back to my point about future and the past looking very different, this made sense because the failure of one firm in an index would be reliably offset by the success of another. So you had this dynamic of mutually offsetting fortune that I think no longer holds true, which threatens the foundation, philosophical foundation of efficient market theory and passive investing in general.
And also maybe of the fact that people believe that they are really diversified, right? By an index, which that's a market myth that maybe it doesn't hold anymore, because when you buy the NASDAQ, you're actually pouring like 30% into 7 companies.
Well, exactly. And so thinking about this, approaching what we're talking about from a different way. So today, I believe Apple has like a 7% position, NVIDIA's 6 or 7, Microsoft's right around 7. But, you know, if you take the entire Mag 7, we're talking about over roughly like somewhere between 30 and 35% of the value of the U.S. stock market. And if you're willing to extrapolate the past, and let's just say for argument's sake, that let's just use those three examples. So Microsoft, Apple, and NVIDIA, let's say they continue to grow at a reduced rate relative for the most part over the last 10 years, and they compound at 15% more than the rest of the index component. So this is a way of saying that the future will look exactly like the past has over the last 10 years, you know, with respect to the next decade. Well, all of a sudden, by definition, now all of a sudden, Apple's 14%, NVIDIA is 12%, Microsoft is 14%. So what's that? Right there, you have almost half the index in three companies. And this is like comically the inverse of what indexation was intended to do from the beginning. You get this perverse outcome where, let's say I'm wrong and past does repeat. At that point, you're going to have basically a half dozen companies that make up the majority of the indices and the S&P 500, but hundreds of positions that are, you know, 6 basis points, 12 basis points. But now you're taking really specific, really substantial security specific risk, which again, validate the whole point of investing. And this kind of leads into the next point about the dynamic of mutually offsetting fortunes no longer holding true, because looking out the next decade, by far the biggest competition that is gunning for our best and brightest head are all, not only are they not in the S&P, some of them are private, like QIA in China, for example. Companies that are vying for technological supremacy, the baton won't be passed, because not only can you not get, are they not included in the S&P 500, some or public at all for that matter, there's no easy way to adjust your portfolio as a passive investor to include that. I mean, there are Chinese indices like the MSCI and CYNA is another, but you know, all the companies I'm talking about that represent the greatest theft are either not in those indices or of such immaterial weight that you're left with kind of this existential problem where, you know, basically companies that are favored and are willing, hungrier, just as smart and innovative are coming at you with absolutely no concern for profitability and margins, when a company that is equally as in terms of products and services competent is willing to earn a low single digit return on capital and was offering equivalent or better products and services at a fraction of the price. There's only one way that's very bad news for the returns, both their earnings and the multiple the market has applied to them. And so you can get a disaster scenario where the index, a whole generation of passive investors have been taught that indexing is the wise way to safely earn a market return. And I feel like there's a certainly non-material risk that they're going to wake up one day basically holding the bat and wondering how they're down 20-30%. And say, just to think about market breadth and the S&P 493, people not indexed, I think, have a much higher probability of doing considerably better without running the massively concentrated risk that are continuing to accelerate in basically the world's most popular investment product.
It's an interesting topic, right? Because we're living in an interesting time where actually before you could call yourself passive and invest in an index. And right now, maybe you can consider yourself active to invest in an index because you're basically getting an exposure that you didn't get before, right? So you need to, it's not like a question of, okay, I'll buy the S&P. Now you have to make a choice. I'm buying the S&P or I'm buying the equal weight S&P, but that's already an active decision because you're basically adjusting for that. So
it flips the principles of indexation firmly on their head. And I mean, who knows? Maybe indexation will go to 90% and the scenario where, you know, the Mag 7 continue to compound at a considerably faster rate than the rest of the index, and we get this kind of top heavy thing. So timing is hard.
Also because you're going to have a lot of funds that are going to do index hiving, right? So as these companies get larger.
Sadly, that's what 99.5% of actively managed investment vehicles. I mean, it is beyond disturbing that for almost all active funds, I don't know, fundamental analysis can basically be broken down into deciding which component of the indices to over and underweight. That is, I mean, they're going to get slaughtered, and I don't know.
Yeah, but their rationale is that if they get slaughtered, they're getting slaughtered with their measuring stick.
Sure. But this gets to the question of how the business of investing and the craft of investing are perversely at odds with almost all institutional actively managed investment product. I mean, I guess that's, maybe they're fine with that, but we're not. At the end of the day, rule number one, don't lose money. Rule number two, see rule number one. And the comfort of the crowd isn't going to make our partners feel better. And nor should I think investors be satisfied, especially when, given the dynamics today, they're investing in something that they didn't sign up for in a very real way.
And they're paying for something that obviously is not a huge value add. Before jumping into some individual companies, I wanted to ask you one last thing, because I see a lot of people claiming that with the arrival of electronic trading, markets have gotten more efficient, but then at the same time, you see a lot of inefficiencies, right? And obviously you can say this in hindsight, but I mean, some companies go to crazy valuations from time to time. And also the reactions, for example, when there's an earnings release are quite crazy, especially because the stock reacts even before any... Even before a human being has had chance to open the document, there's already some algorithm that has read the document or has seen the numbers and is acting based on that. Do you think that markets are more efficient today than they were 10 years ago? Or do you think that mispricing, just due to the nature of the human being, are always going to remain?
I think it's the latter. I think we strive to fish where the fish are. What I mean by that is the pockets of the capital markets that are the most kind of structurally inefficient. And today there's all types of craziness that is, I don't know, in a sense, I think that the market might be more efficient generally with, say, larger kind of mega cap businesses, but it's always been that way. And conversely, I could name probably 24 mega cap companies over the last 10 years that have gotten grossly mispriced, despite the fact that they have 100 analysts covering it and a million eyeballs. So I think, as always, you have to pick your spots and opportunity knock everywhere. But I will say that when it comes to our bread and butter, as a firm that kind of traffics in the smaller, less liquid fare, I think the markets are wildly inefficient. But, you know, it also, this actually ties in with indexation and the way the Fed has stepped in and created consistent liquidity. With the rise of indexation, you have just a structural trend where, you know, any name that isn't big enough and liquid enough to meet the index's formulas gets left behind. And nowhere is this more evident than in the small cap value space, where even through this year, it's been a bloodbath in general. But that these structural trends, at least until they definitively reverse, three kind of new conundrums. I mean, there's a comment that I made in one of our annual letters, but that kind of gets the heart of the issue. With the rise of indexation and the fact that there's only, at this point, very few stocks big enough and liquid enough to absorb the trillions in capital flows that are being poured into these things. It's like Ben Graham always talks about, in the short run, the market, the voting machine; in the long run, it's a weighing machine. Well, given the changes in market structure, the question is, well, what happens if no one shows up at the poll? And I think that is made navigating, at least the way Crossroads has adapted and evolved to deal with these issues. On the one hand, you have opportunities that are off the beaten path that can be extraordinarily high quality, with the right leader, the right culture, the whole fact pattern of what makes a perfect investment there, but no one cares. Capital flows and other dynamics are based.
I think that's the toughest part, right? Of investing in smaller caps, the incremental buyer.
Yes, exactly. And so, and then there's the fact that a lot of these companies have owner operators that might own 20 or 30% of the float, which that all of this, it creates this kind of doom loop. So the way we have adjusted our strategy really since the inception of Crossroads, because I think this had been clear 8 years ago when we started, is to the importance of a catalyst, something that will not only tell us what's going to make the stock work, but specifically when it will work, I think has become essential, because counting on the marginal buyer in the way, or a rational marginal buyer like you have in the past, I think a dangerous premise to take on. And Einhorst has talked about this, but most of the time that these catalysts will be both to be various corporate events, but, you know, it could be just basic capital allocation. These things can actually work to your advantage if you have, say, a management team, very stable business with very consistent, predictable cash flows that's trading at some stupid valuation because of these structural factors that have nothing to do with its intrinsic business value. And they're taking all that excess cash flow and rapidly shrinking the flow as fast as they can, that's something that's going to get our ear really hurt. And we'll probably talk mostly of Nintendo today, and maybe we'll talk about history for another time. But the dynamics today are actually the best you could hope for companies like this.
So earlier in the show, you heard us talk about the investing platform public.com. That's where you can trade options with no commissions or per contract fees, and you get a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. NerdWallet recently gave Public 5 out of 5 stars for options trading. If you want to see why, go to public.com and start getting a rebate of up to 18 cents per contract traded. Paid for by Public Investing. Options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description. US members only. Back to the episode. I think this is a good moment to talk about Bistree if you want, because I mean, you somewhat explained, right, part of the case there of the catalyst that Bistree can enjoy. So if you want, you can explain briefly what the investment thesis behind Bistree. And if people know NVR, then it's going to be easy to see.
Very much so. And if I'm skipping over things that don't be clear, feel free to interject. But I guess maybe I'd start with like one of the ways we think there's some insane opportunity at the moment in kind of non-domestic market in the UK in particular. And in a lot of ways, it's much as the great country, the capital markets there, the business culture, it's a nightmare. I mean, I think it trades at the discount it does, generally speaking, for a number of very good reasons. And so one of the ways in terms of our strategy that we have exploited this kind of present dynamic is one of two ways where it's a business listed in the UK, but most of it, call it revenue and cash flow, is based in the US, where there is a clear hard catalyst, a liquidity-driven catalyst, whether that's an uplist or a listing in the US. And there's been a number of names where we've bought very good businesses that could never have traded at the multiples that they were trading at, end up listing in the US, and we've earned very attractive risk-adjusted returns for arbitraging that gap. Now, the other part of our UK strategy is the inverse of that. And what I mean is when you have companies that are very stable, generating very predictable non-cyclical cash flows, and the right culture and management team that is returning capital to shareholders via kind of continuous buyback, a market like the UK is kind of nirvana. Everyone's focused on dividends. There's gross mispricings everywhere, but a dirt cheap valuation, well below anything I think that could be reasonably considered as fair, is a huge benefit because they can buy back more stock at higher implied buyback yield. And you get really crazy exponential right-tailed outcomes when you have this dynamic. I mean, without looking at IRR or NVR, I mean, I think it's bought back 80% of its shares since the mid-90s. It's up something like 800 times since it initially restructured. And there are a variety of reasons for that. But we don't have to wait for the incremental buyer or for the market to wake up one day and realize that this earnings stream is worth considerably more. The company is self-catalyzing the outcome and ensuring a very attractive outcome, no matter.
So the company is the incremental buyer.
Yes, exactly. And the compounding, like if you look at Azio or AutoZone, the super famous case study, basically the broad framework to think about this is AutoZone was a very stable business. I think over the 13 years where I'm no fan of Eddie Lampert, but in this respect was a brilliant capital allocation strategy. I think over the 13 years he was in control, EBITDA grew at the mid single digits, but they bought back over those 13 years 75% plus of the equity. And so as you have a shrinking denominator on a growing numerator creates exponential outcomes. In AZO's case, I think it was 13 times in 13 years. So whether you're looking at NVR or AZO, when a company with the right culture, the right business, when everything comes together in this way, having a cheap stock married to continuous buybacks creates just semi-mind-blowing outcomes in the end. So with that said, I think Bistree is very akin to NVR and very akin to AZO in that specific way. So what is Vistory? What do they do? So for basic background, they're a UK-based home builder that's basically in the process of pivoting to an economically resilient asset-light, high ROIC partnerships business that has thus far largely been obscured by the repurposing and liquidation of its lower return, capital intensive, traditional home building business. Traditional home building is a business that, or at least, you know, specifically with Vistory, that has deteriorated due to higher rates, as all traditional home builders are highly susceptible to changes in interest rate. While the transformation or business model transformation towards the partnership business is uniquely cycle agnostic and immune to rate and inflation related movement. And that is a absolutely huge critical qualitative point to understand. Equally as important is you have a number of US activist investors that have been pushing for a transition to become very NBR-like in their capital allocation policy over the last few years. And they are basically replicating it to a T. We even have a former NBR board member that joined Vistory's board in mid-23 or thereabout. So on top of that, by business, again, we look for businesses undergoing value unlocking change for the past. The future is, you know, very different. By winding down and repurposing the traditional home building over the next, over these last couple of years, that should unlock roughly, from the time it started, $1.3 billion in cash. And this is essentially 30% of the market cap that should be released. And this should free up roughly $1 billion for share buyback. So you're talking about a quarter to a third of capital in the near term that will be recycled into shrinking the float. So that background out of the way, the opportunity is, I think we have a catalyst-driven, high-quality compounder with a widening moat and stable and highly predictable cash flow that is essentially trading as if the opposite is true. They're transitioning.
Why do you think that is? What do you think the market consensus?
Well, the consensus was, and intriguingly, this has started to really change. I think we've had four or five of the prominent sell side firms come out and basically reverse their initial skepticism. But, you know, the issue was, could partnerships scale at a fast enough rate to not just hit their medium-term goals, but to replace the associated revenue and profit from the traditional house building segment? And so as time has gone on, initially when this, I'd say 6 months to a year ago, you had deep skepticism throughout the sell side on top of all the other kind of structural issues related to the UK. The company today still trades at crazy prices, but I think a kind of wide scale grand narrative shift has already begun to take place. And as they continue to execute as they have to date, you're going to see sentiment in the general framework in which people view and value the business inflect materially for the better. And the reasons for this is it's just simply the partnership business is superior to a traditional home builder in basically every way. I mean, the partnerships is asset light. Traditional home building is asset intensive. The returns on capital, cash returns, are 2 to 3 times of traditional home building. 60 to 70% of these homes that the partnership business builds are pre-sold. This dramatically reduces revenue volatility and cyclicality, limits capital outlays. And most importantly, this all relates to the affordable housing crisis in the UK, which is not only dramatically more acute than it is in the US, but I think the fact is the idea that there's any other business or company partnerships business that could help the government close that gap. And I think both parties are very much there. Everyone agrees that affordable housing needs to be prioritized and dealt with. So if they want to solve the problem, there's really only one business in the UK with the requisite community construction and development know-how, with decades of experience with the people and assets in place to close that gap. Without Countryside, the problem not only doesn't get solved, it gets worse. And I think we're already far past the point where you're going to get the pitchforks if something isn't done, and there's only one business that can realistically, you know, partner with the government to meet its goals. So anyhow, a big part of this opportunity is with the removal of home building via this, call it slow motion, 2-year reclass liquidation, you're going to see the quality of their earning stream of partnerships earning power shining through, which the market doesn't appreciate, but within the next, call it 18 months, they will be forced to. I think the results will speak for themselves, but at current prices, it's trading at sub 4x medium-term earnings power, which is just absolutely insane for a business that can do 40% plus returns on capital, that is returning it copious cash flows to shareholders via buyback. And when you look at true comparables, whether that's NBR or just capital light home builders in general, Vistry is trading at roughly 3.5x medium term earnings power. And you have capital light home builders like NBR trading at 50 to 20 times. So either way we win, if the stock stays cheap, they'll buy back 80% of the float in shocking time. And that's going to force a base melting re-rate or general investor appreciation for the quality and runway of this business will inflect towards reality, and the multiple will, either way we win basically. So, And we don't have to worry about a friend. Yeah. You had a comment that I always found amusing and also true, that multiple expansion is for suckers. We don't need the market to bid up the multiple or to recognize.
That's your finality, right? Your potential upside that you're not counting on.
Yes. We basically, the company can self-catalyze a wonderful outcome without having to worry about what the incremental buyers. And I think this is, again, how we've changed up our strategy. Given the changes in market structure and various dynamics, it's especially in the small value space, it's incredibly dangerous. I mean, what's the Burry quote? Check your premise. I think situations like this, where the company itself, through being intelligent and farsighted, you know, removes all these risks and gets the end game will remain the same, regardless of whether the market in general starts to appreciate it, its qualitative attribute. Either way we win, multiple ways to win, and really difficult to imagine a scenario where one could permanently lose money.
And I'll leave your letter in the description, as I said before, and you can go, if you're listening or watching this, you can go read their more extensive, let's say, investment thesis on the company. I would like to, over the last 10 minutes or so, talk about Nintendo, because you've been vocal about the company's business transformation. And it's interesting because in the last podcast with Speedwell, Nintendo actually came up as, okay, if you look at the past, Nintendo has been a great asset, right? They always had a great asset, which is their IP, but it was not a great company, right? Maybe because management was not, let's say, as proactive in monetizing that asset or in monetizing it in a recurring way. But you believe, and I also believe, I'm a shareholder, that things are changing. So can you talk about the business transformation that Nintendo has seen over the last couple of years, which, by the way, has been more or less confirmed lately?
Yes, I'd say every fundamental pillar of the thesis has been more than confirmed, especially this last year, seventh year into a aging console cycle, record revenue and profit. Only thing I'd say about Nintendo's past with respect to your discussion is, if you're gauging quality by returns on equity, and I think the go back and look at Nintendo's historical returns over 5, 10, 20 years, even when it was the insular and basically in that state of being scarred by grossly under-monetizing basically the world's most valuable video game IP, in the end, over time, they did do quite well for shareholders. And I also think there's something to be said for overt caution versus reckless monetization. I think I could go off on Disney for an hour, and they impair and are on a path towards unforced errors of destroying one of the most valuable, not only portfolios of entertainment-related IP, but just 100 years of tradition and brand.
I think Disney maybe shows what could have happened to Nintendo if they would have overexploited their idea.
So I think that it's important. One of the things from studying and owning Nintendo for so long is, and you could see this in their approach to mobile, their refusal to play the photorealistic rat race, which has recently shown just how far-sighted they were in this respect. I mean, I think Western software devs that focus there, their business at Sony and Microsoft, it's arguable that their business model is permanently impaired. I mean, when you have to spend $300 million on a video game, and it's not just the development of the video game, but, you know, these are like live action or motion capture movies. The expense is just insane.
Or $60 billion in buying IP.
Yes, exactly. And then working hard to destroy that IP, or at least not get any games, or at least good games released after you've bought it. But there's real issues, structurally speaking, where this is why you're seeing Microsoft go multi-platform, and in a lesser way, Sony doing the same. It's the cost of developing these photorealistic games has made it essential that, I mean, their existing installed bases aren't big enough to make the return on investment worthwhile. And that is a massive problem, and even more so when you consider most of these games that come out on PS4 and PS5. And we're talking about in terms of the different, I mean, yet does a PS5 game developed for the PS5 look better than, say, a counterpart on the PS4? Yes. Is that incremental difference something that makes the gameplay or the experience any better? Absolutely not. I mean, we hit diminishing returns a long time ago, and I think that puts Nintendo's peers in a really difficult position in a lot of ways. But back to Nintendo, basically, our thesis has always been about its business model transformation. Since getting involved from the beginning, we believe that most investors have basically incorrectly judged Nintendo and viewed it via an obsolete paradigm of its past history of cyclical boom bust earnings. And to drill down on that simplistically, it's that every few years, the company would launch a new game console that, once it gained popularity, eventually became obsolete and needed to be replaced. So in stark contrast to the consensus, we argued that what is the most dangerous words in investing, that this time is different, and that Nintendo was transforming and structurally changing the very essence of its business model from that boom-bust, hit-driven, cyclical model towards an indefinitely lived platform at the center of a software-based ecosystem. The closest analogy is Apple's iPhone. So that had a number of kind of profound implications. The first is that the Switch platform, unlike past Nintendo home and portable consoles, would be perpetual. And what that means is it ensures Nintendo's user base would essentially continually grow with each new iteratively improved version of its hardware, rather than resetting to zero with the launch of an entirely new console, as it had in the kind of pre-Switch era. In the past, and this was the driver of, I call it console roulette, with every hit console, they basically, all of the progress they made would reset to zero, and they'd have to roll the dice again and hope for a hit that they could rebuild. And so intrinsically, and this is what I was talking earlier, it's not about predicting if the future, it's about gaining a better understanding of the present. And we realized this very early years. I mean, for years, people thought we were nuts. But similarly to the hardware, we argued that the software library would remain evergreen as well. So think of this like apps in Apple's App Store or games on Valve's Steam service for PCs. So just as lots of different PCs can access Steam, lots of different Switch family devices would be able to access Switch game library. And while the hardware would iterate and improve over time, the software ecosystem would be forever. And that is just a fundamental disagreement about the very nature of its business and its future trajectory, which is one of the reasons looking to the past is fraught with risk to understand the business it is today and the business it was 5 years ago when we initially put out the thesis. So, as we just discussed, here we are 5 years later, nearly 5 years later. And I think I heard Pete switch every year for 4 years in a row. But the long-awaited cyclical reversion in Nintendo's and sales and profit never came, even though the sell side has been calling for it every year since we got involved. I think through a number of factors, just time and just the objective evidence, the thesis or our thesis is gradually gained acceptance. The market's misperception is basically slowly yielding to economic reality. But even today, the consensus view still misses large chunks of the structural implications of the business model transformation, really despite significant and relentless evidence otherwise. So we've had the
announcement of a new system. Obviously, they didn't refer to it as Switch 2, but a lot of people are expecting that. Then you also have management's commitment to develop, or let's say produce, more movies, right? They're like one a year. I think in 2025 we're going to have Zelda, and 2026 another Mario movie or something like that. So obviously the transformation is underway, right? So what risk do you think that remain now that we are more along the curve?
Yeah, so I think this is going to be a totally unsat. I know as a value investor, I'm supposed to start rattling off a number of risk. I don't think at this valuation there is any material risks left with respect to the thesis. I think Nintendo is what we've long said it was, an inevitable, to use Buffett parlance, the high return secular growth juggernaut that will continually just keep getting bigger and better, more profitable with time. As you mentioned, outside of the core video game business, the IP flywheel is in full effect, and the earnings snowball from those non-core divisions is working its way up to steady state. But I think the real kicker, where the afterburners kick in, is with the release of higher powered hardware, i.e. the Switch 2, and the normalization in its software slate. Basically, Nintendo has created an Apple-like ecosystem that has been reinforced, ironically enough, by a very Disney-like IP content flywheel. And the sum total of these changes has resulted in a radically improved, more economically resilient revenue and cash flow, completely de-cyclifying its earnings power. And we have a number of near-term events that will continue to vastly improve or build on the quality, stability, and magnitude of Nintendo's earnings. You have higher first-party software prices. You have a step change increase in the availability of third-party AAA games. You have a much larger, higher spending active user base. You have incredible untapped pricing power at Nintendo Switch Online. And,
you also have something that I feel a lot of people don't talk much when they're talking about the movies, right? Is the marketing leverage that they, the Mario movie generated more than 1 billion in ticket sales, but it's not that. Like, the real return is how many Switches were sold, how many Mario games were sold based on that movie. I don't know the answer. What's the return?
Well, in terms of Mario games, the uplift was, I think, 30% last year, but, we haven't even begun to see its power. I mean, imagine pairing the new 3D Mario with a Mario movie. All the incredible free marketing spend. Strategically, there's other just incredibly important elements to this. I mean, you see every day kids in kindergarten reenacting Bowser's Peach song. This is just a simple way to say that the most important thing for the durability and longevity of Nintendo's competitive advantage period of its moat is passing on the love that was inspired, and I was a part of kind of the original Nintendo generation, passing that on to kids. And one of the other of many just brutally unfortunate mistakes with Sony and Microsoft is they've essentially ceded the kids video game market and to Nintendo, and with that, the durability of their own ecosystem. So it's a huge deal, but you add everything I just laid and then throw in the continued shift towards the digitalization of its sales. And for context, Nintendo was about 4 to 5 years behind its peers, both on the console and development side with respect to this trend. We'll always probably have a higher percentage in terms of physical sales than the other two. But even if you put it at the low end, the uplift to margins and operating profit just from that alone will make you rub your eyes and check again. But the bottom line is the stock is dirt cheap. We have 4 to 5 years at least, I think, truly explosive growth in both revenue and profit. This is not uncertain. This is, in fact, highly certain. if you look at the games that have been in development for 6 to 7 years and beyond, i.e. that we should see first party games, system sellers drop within the first 18 months of the Switch 2's release, you can, I won't spoil the fun. All analysts out there should go and do the math for themselves, but just on a first party basis, yeah, given the higher price points, Switch 2 games like Tears of the Kingdom will likely be sold at 70, or at least their the core franchise of them will. So you have a kind of a tidal wave of system selling first party games. You're going to have an absolute explosion in third party games. I mean, one of the things that isn't talked about enough, but you know, Xbox is essentially imploding and is essentially ceding its share of the high-end gaming market as it made acquisitions and more both out of necessity and due to various M&A, is moving in an entirely different direction. Nintendo is heading into the next generation with the largest installed base, the power of the hardware, the intergenerational compatibility. One of the other side effects, by the way, a quick side tangent, of not only Microsoft's or the Xbox implosion, but the structural factors that are severely curtailing profitability at both Sony and Microsoft is devs. The installed bases aren't big enough for them to prioritize making games. It used to be Sony and Microsoft would be the priority and all of their development activities would be focused on that. Well, the economics don't even make sense anymore, certainly for Microsoft. And not only will we be entering this next generation with Nintendo, the undisputed leader, but I think you're going to see and I think you already see this in the number and what we know will be released, but a sea change towards Western devs turning their efforts. Basically, the Switch 2 will be the fundamental platform that they develop for, with Xbox and even potentially Sony being secondary to that. And that's just a matter of basic economic incentives and capitalism. Nintendo has the biggest profit pool. The power-related bottleneck that prevented high-fidelity versions of their games from playing properly is going away. They have every reason in the world, economically and strategically speaking, to make Nintendo the focus of all of the next generation game. So I think that's a very big deal. So I think transition is essentially complete. I think with the Switch 2, it's not even economic. I mean, regardless of how obstinate and you want to be past this console changeover, holding on to the cyclical boom bust narrative and the paradigms of the past becomes not just intellectually dishonest, impossible to maintain. So I think that has positive implications for how investors view the stock and the multiple it trades at. But I mean, let's just look at the valuation. Should I go there and wrap it up?
Yeah, but I think that's the natural last point on Nintendo.
Yeah, so stock is preposterously cheap, both on normalized earnings 2 to 3 years out, assuming zero value for all of its non-core asset, its giant pile of cash, over 20% of the market cap. Zero all that out, and the stock is trading at a ludicrously low multiple, even on trailing numbers. If you assign value to their control of the Pokemon company and the Pokemon franchise in general, they have a stake in the Seattle Mariners. Again, the 20% market cap in cash, the trailing multiple is, call it mid to high single digit, depending on where you want to value, in particular, the Pokemon company. But I don't expect all of these non-core hidden assets. I mean, the Pokemon company is arguably the most valuable hidden asset on Earth, if not the most valuable entertainment-related IP company in the world, even above and over Nintendo. And the fact that I think it's valued at, on its balance sheet at the princely sum of something like $2.8 million. But these are all very real assets that, you know, not only whose value is not only durable, but should continue to rise in value with time. Let's zero all that out and assume it's worth nothing. Even then, I think essentially a certainty at this point, if we want to use steady state assumptions of, I don't know, 135 million active user base, give or take, assuming a third of them have NSO subscriptions, assuming, I think with the Switch 2, we'll get another higher price subscription tier for Nintendo Switch Online is obviously a very highly valuable earning stream worth well above 20 times. It'll still represent a tiny fraction of what rival offerings from its peers charge. But if you assume the trend towards digital and the downloads, just the digitization of its sales only comes to 50% of the total Nintendo's total software and hardware revenue in 5 years. And I think this is an absurd assumption. I think with time, it should balance out around 75 to 80%. But even there, and assuming a moderate earnings multiple of, call it roughly 20 times, we're getting $43 a share or 220% upside, give or take. And so I think I'll just wrap. I have never seen a company of this quality, of this durability, with this, not only they can literally, through various monetizing their IP in various ways, print $1 billion revenue stream out of thin air by just basic blocking and tackling. It's an extraordinarily special company, and it trades at a fundamentally unsustainable multiple. Whether you want to zero out the cash and non-core long-term investments or not. And even crazier, I think, if you were to go back and look at history, and this is a kind of a great way to wrap everything up, if you were to buy Nintendo, let's say the Switch 2 gets released a year from now. I think it likely drops, call it March of next year, but let's just say it doesn't get released till now. Well, if you go back and look at history and bought Nintendo's equity 1 year prior to a new console launch and sold, call it 2 years after that launch took place, I think the average return across every console release, both home and portable, over time is something like 220% or 200-ish. So which dovetails actually perfectly with our almost hyper-conservative, to the point of trollishness, price target that we just laid out. So if history is any guide, there is no better time to get involved with Nintendo's equity than right about a year prior to launch. And I think there are a number of very good reasons for why the returns have always been consistently so good. And given the structural and fundamental radical improvements to the business model, one might argue that this next time around, looking forward 3 years from today, the upside should be considerably better than what history would suggest, given it's a fundamentally transformed, much better business than it has been at any other point in its past. So that was kind of a lot. I apologize.
That's great.
Trying to get a lot in a little time.
And I think a good way to wrap up the conversation, which has been great, is I always end with this question. What's your favorite book and why? Can be investing or not investment related.
That's a really tough question.
There are too many, right?
Yes. It's like being asked, why do you love your mom? Where to even begin? I have favorites in my genre. I think business, and I've always been philosophy nut. It's a very hard question to answer. I can give you two books that I have particularly enjoyed within the last few years that I think, if you're a history buff, an investing buff, that I think will pay, you'll thoroughly enjoy. And so off the top of my head, I'd say The Dark Genius of Wall Street about Jay Gould. There's a lot of background and context, but history has painted him as this ruthless robber baron with morals and of the worst. One of the things that's so interesting here is that he actively cultivated that kind of reputation because it served his business interest in a sense. But I think it was 1984, the family actually released, just enormous troves of his, personal and business correspondence, the multi-decade length of his career, to the Harvard Business School. And so I'm naturally attracted to situations where optics and reality are very different things. And I think that a fair analysis of his character, given what we now know, but did not know until relatively speaking, very relatively recently, that on average, I think he was a far better man than most of the great capitalists of the Gilded Age that we lionize today. I think that indisputably factual. Maybe that's an argument for another day, but more importantly, I think the book is absolutely, next level in the sense that I feel like Gould, and they go through this in real time. The power of his intellect and skill set is just utterly insane. It's like rolling up Buffett, Munger, John Malone, and Henry Singleton into one individual. He, I think, was the first. There's arguments, Rockefeller, in terms of establishing low-cost business models and sustainable advantages. But, you know, he, I don't agree with everything he did. Some of it was, as people claim, but as a historical figure that investors today could learn a lot about or a lot from. And was just he was just one of the most creative, multifaceted, brilliant businessmen to ever live. He might be the single greatest Western capitalist in all of history. I think that'd be debatable, but he doesn't get his due. He's deeply underappreciated. And then another book that I really enjoyed was, I think it's Jacob McDonald's, I have it up on my shelf, Capital Allocation, where he goes through and basically follows Buffett's investments and specifically his capital allocation from his partnership days. And just as someone that loves history and loves Buffett and everything he's built, I found that like a fascinatingly long overdue treatise on one of the great investors in history that just shockingly had never been done before. When I saw it, I was like, why hasn't anyone thought to write this before? And I think he did an incredible job. So those are probably two books I would, at least for your listeners, I would recommend people dive into.
I've not read them, so I really have two more purchases to do. So thanks a lot, Ryan. I think it has been a great conversation. I mean, we touched, I don't know how many topics, but we went pretty much over everything.
Yeah. Hopefully it was coherent.
I think it was. It was
great. I can get going. My friends like to joke that I'm the wind-up doll, talking about something that I'm passionate about. I go off the rails, but I've had a blast. Leandro, thank you again for having me. Hopefully everyone enjoys it. I certainly have.